A book had been written on it in the 1800s. A couple of dissertations had referred to it. A short essay in a journal in the 1950s had told the story. And a B-grade 1950s novel had been based on it. Steven Spielberg was 2 decades from hearing about it and producing the movie. During the time when I was doing my research and writing, Claudia and my kids made the banner that you see, which we subsequently hung on our wall, and it stayed there for a number of years. And there it is. I found it in the attic the other day and brought it along for show and tell. Anticipating Kairos. I want to begin with a definition. And I apologize for using theological jargon, but I think this works. Kairos is a Greek word that basically means time. The Greeks also had another word for time, chronos, from which we get such words as chronology. Chronos has to do with the everyday passage of time, that is, measured time. On the other hand, kairos carries the meaning of opportune time or perfect time, the perfect time to do, to act, those moments in time that when seized make a difference. In Christian theology, kairos has been used to designate those moments when divine action provides an opportunity for human response and action. Anticipating, watching for, expecting kairos was a key element in early congregational theology. In his essay, Chiron Autou, an Increased Mather, the 17th century congregational theologian and president of Harvard University, defined kairos in these words: there is a season, a fit time, for Christians to go to work in, if they take hold of that nick of opportunity, they will prosper and succeed in their endeavors. In the summer of 1839, a mysterious, long, black schooner lay anchored off Long Island. Its shredded sails and dark hull formed an ominous profile against the Atlantic horizon. For weeks, newspapers from cities along the entire eastern seaboard of the United States had printed reports of the mystery ship slipping into sight and then disappearing, a ghostly apparition of the sea. But there off Long Island, the schooner was only too real. The name La Amistad identified it as a slave-bearing vessel out of Havana. On August 26, 1839, the U.S. brig Washington boarded the vessel and towed it to New London, where the 43 Africans on board were jailed on charges of murder and piracy. This event, with no obvious pretext to historical significance, prompted the New York businessman Lewis Tappan to write to his fellow abolitionist Leonard Bacon, "We ought to make the most of this providential occurrence." There it is. He's referring to the kairos moment. And he continues, "The simple truth, wisely pressed, must produce a lasting effect. This is calculated to produce discussion that will bring out the whole matter of slaves as well as the slave trade." Perhaps you've seen the movie. If so, you've experienced the power of the story. It stayed with me all these years, and I've never grown tired of it. The cinematography, the drama, the portrayals of John Quincy Adams and of Tseng Bei provide a vivid insight into this historical event. It's quite a good movie, actually, but the movie is a Hollywood project, and Hollywood stories can play loose with history. Because of his aim to entertain, or his biases, or both, Spielberg misses the real point of the story when he makes the abolitionists into silly caricatures of Christianity. The historical reality was quite different. Within days of the arrest of the Africans, New York abolitionists deployed Yale linguist Josiah Gibbs to find someone who could speak the language and could act as an interpreter in court. And so Gibbs went to the jail and he learned how to count in the language of the Africans. And then he went and walked up and down the docks of New Haven, off New Haven, and counting in the language that he had learned, and until someone responded, a young ship hand heard someone counting in his home language and came to Josiah Gibbs and told him, "These people are from Mindi. They are Mindi from Sierra Leone, the southern part of Sierra Leone in Western Africa." At the same time, the abolitionists sought out Roger Baldwin to act as legal counsel for the Africans. If you remember the movie, Roger Baldwin was portrayed as a youthful, inexperienced ambulance chaser who just happened to fall into the case. In reality, he was a congregational layperson in his early 50s who was a longtime abolitionist. He had worked on a case 10 years before having to do with the attempt and failure to establish a college for blacks in New Haven. He was the grandson of a revolutionary patriot and later became governor of Connecticut. Immediately, three abolitionists were named as a committee called the Friends of the Amistad. Louis Tappan, Joshua Levitt, and Simeon Jocelyn were the members of the committee, and they were assigned the task of raising funds, attending to the needs of the Africans, and assuring that they had access to the U.S. legal system. Their commission placed them against general public feeling, against a president vying for Southern votes, against international politics of expediency, against the accepted categorization of the Africans as property. Louis Tappan was the organizing force that drove the Amistad defense. Unfortunately, in the movie, he is portrayed as a pathological religionist on the sidelines of the story. Tappan had grown up in the cradle of New England Congregationalism and later moved to New York, where he and his brother Arthur were successful businessmen. He and his brother were progressive humanitarians and abolitionists, deeply involved in a variety of social causes. They understood wealth as something not to be hoarded, but to be shared for the sake of the public good. They made and gave away several fortunes during their lifetimes, and they died with virtually no personal estate. Lewis was one of the first white people to see the veiled racism of the Colonization Society, a movement to repatriate African Americans to Africa. He devoted his energies to abolitionism and the sharing of the American social franchise with African Americans. Through his leadership in the abolitionist movement and in the establishment of schools for escaped and freed slaves, his contributions to African American history are immeasurable. He thrust his life and his resources into the total overthrow of slavery. Because of his abolitionist work, 5 years before the Amistad incident, his home had been pillaged and his furniture burned in the street. In 1835, the Tabernacle Church, which he and Arthur were building, was burned. He and his brother received constant assassination threats. Through all of that, he persisted. There is universal agreement today among scholars that Louis Tappan's careful and level-headed management of the Amistad case brought a new credibility to abolitionism that made it a formidable political force in the 1840s and 1850s. Joshua Levitt, the second member of the Amistad defense, like the Tappans, grew up in the New England religious cradle of Congregationalism. With degrees from Yale in both law and divinity, he had been a pastor and an activist in social causes. He was a founder of the Liberty Party, which was a forerunner of Abraham Lincoln's Republican Party. Different Republican Party than today. At the time of the Amistad incident, he was the impassioned editor of the abolitionist journal, The Emancipator. In his salutary editorial of 1837 in that paper, he wrote, "In the strength of Israel's God, we gave ourselves to this work till it shall be done, the cause of human rights." Simeon Jocelyn, the third member of the committee, was the pastor of a church for free blacks in New Haven. The spiritual counselor to the Tappans, Simeon was a man of deep religious conviction and ironic spirit, wholly devoted to the battle against slavery. When his plans for a school for African Americans in New Haven were dashed by a racist community uprising, he wrote, "Our beautiful city is clothed in sackcloth. Our proud elms hang their heads." One other character in the story deserves to be mentioned because of his involvement in the return of the Africans to their Mende homeland and the formation of the American Missionary Association. James W.C. Pennington, the head of the African American Union Missionary Society. It's interesting to me, if you remember the story, the movie, that there was a character named Jodson. You remember the black abolitionist in the story? It's interesting to me that they manufactured that character. It looks like if they had done their homework, Pennington would have been a fitting person to be depicted in this role. He was an escaped slave who had run away when he was 20 years old. In his autobiography, he tells of deciding to escape when he saw his owner lash his father unmercifully with a cowhide whip. He wrote, "Although it was some time after this event before I took the decisive step, yet in my mind and spirit, I never was a slave after that." Attending night school, he became a school teacher and later a Congregationalist pastor, author, and lecturer. When Yale would not admit him to the classroom, he audited all of the classes for ordination by standing in the doorway and listening to the lectures. Pennington was the author of the first textbook history of African Americans. He was the founder and leader of the African American Union Missionary Society. In 1841, the Amistad Committee, Joshua Levitt and Louis Tappan and Simeon Jocelyn, turned to the UMS, the Union Missionary Society, to send the Africans home. In 1846, the Amistad Committee and the Union Missionary Society reorganized to form the American Missionary Association with Pennington among its executive officers. The Amistad event and the success of the abolitionist in defending the Africans all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court form a critical nexus in American history, giving abolitionism credibility and energy that ultimately led to the downfall of slavery. The American Missionary Association, That organization formed by the Amistad Defense Committee and the Union Missionary Society became the principal agency of the abolitionists for the attack on slavery and the enfranchisement of African Americans. It understood its mission not only as one of conversion, but as an instrument for social justice. This emphasis on social justice and the association's refusal to take money from slaveholders caused it to become the principal mission arm of the Congregational churches. Its predecessors, the Amistad Committee and the Union Missionary Society, sent both black and white missionaries to the Mende, commissioned to confront slavery head on right there in Africa. In the United States, the American Missionary Association moved to establish churches along the border states as barriers to the spread of slavery and as stations on the Underground Railroad. During the Civil War, the American Missionary Association sent black and white school marms into the South on the heels of the Union Army to begin over 300 schools for freed slaves. In fact, most of the New England school marms were African American. Those schools, some of which are still in existence, have educated countless numbers of African American leaders in the past century and a half in our country. Fisk University, Dillard University are two notable examples. The Amistad Defenders gathered in 1841 to bid farewell to the Mende Africans as they sailed for home. Simeon Josselyn was asked to preach a farewell sermon. He spoke of anticipating Kairos as hope in the present. Hope that is watchful for means to put in our hands to work for justice. And his words still admonish us today. Do not promise yourself or the world good for future generations if you have not hope for the present in the use of the means put into your hands by the Savior. And he closed with these words, not on the banner, work for the living with all your might.